Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for Monday, March 13th, 2023. And today I want to try to answer what I think is probably the most important question, if not, it's top three easily. How should a free people or how should a free people respond to unconstitutional acts of the government, or what should a free people do in response? Now, what most people do today in response to stuff that they think the federal government shouldn't do is one of three things. First, they tend to call their rep or march on Washington, D.C., and basically what they're doing is they're demanding that people in government stop or start doing something that they shouldn't have been doing in the first place. But even mostly we're talking about stopping them. But let's say this actually worked. I'd make a case, first of all, that it's a totally failed strategy. It's still really not a state of freedom, because if we're thinking about what a free people does, let's start with that. And say George Tucker in his 1803 view of the Constitution of the United States put it like this: it is the due restraint and not the moderation of rulers that constitutes a state of liberty. As the power to oppress, though never exercised, does a state of slavery. So what we're talking about here, again, if we're talking about what does a free people do? A free people does not wait for permission from government that supposedly is supposed to be the agent of the people. A free people doesn't beg for freedom. It doesn't ask for it. It doesn't demand for it. It takes it. And we're going to get into a little bit more of that in just a moment. So just because you go to Washington, D.C., or you demand, you make some phone calls, and you get the people who are doing the wrong thing, somehow you convince them to stop doing the wrong thing in the first place, this isn't a state of freedom, according to St. George Tucker, and we'll get to others here in just a moment, because that's just that's just the moderation of rulers. Those are the people that are doing the right thing at that moment, or because it's politically important for them, because there's such an outcry about such an issue. That's not it, because as long as they still have the power to do the wrong thing, then you're in, as St. George Tucker puts it, a state of slavery. Here's how John Dickinson put it. He said, "For who are a free people?" And I've covered this quote many times, or this little phrase here many times, from letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania, 1767, against the hated Townsend Acts. This is what earned him the title, the series of papers earned him the title, the Penman of the American Revolution, because he wrote the most widely read documents on American liberty. And this is how people understood stuff generally. "For who are a free people?" He said, "Not those over whom government is reasonable and equitably exercised." Same thing that St. George Tucker had to say all the way up in 1803. It's just not just because the government happens to be doing the right thing. You're not free in that situation. You're lucky. He said, "But those who live under a government so constitutionally checked and controlled that proper provision is made against it being otherwise exercised." In other words, as soon as it tries to get out of line, there's a quick slap back and, you know, catch these hands, you can't do it. It's not about asking the government to stop doing stuff after the fact. It's about stopping them right when they try to do the wrong thing. And for us, that's constantly. They're always doing the wrong thing. Here's how John Adams put it back when he was one of the good guys, February 6, 1775. "Nip the shoots of arbitrary power in the bud." He's using a Latin phrase that I know had been used by many. It was considered a maxim. James Otis Jr. wrote it some years earlier as well. "Obsta principiis," I believe it is. It really translates to "nip it in the bud." And Adams is saying, "Nip it in the bud" is the only maxim which can ever preserve the liberties of any people. That's the only way. As long as you let it get out of control, it's going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And Adams, in that series of Novanglish letters in 1775, he mentioned that, well, encroachment upon the Constitution is like a cancer. It just grows faster and faster. It's like a deadly disease. And I should mention that these links, these original source documents that I'm citing here in this episode, I publish a blog post about 1 to 2 hours after each live stream is done, and there you'll find a section, show links, 10thamendmentcenter.com/path-to-liberty. That's where they're all published. You can find all the archives of the show, all the different platforms we're on. We're a bunch of video platforms, live streaming. Some of them are archive only, for example, like Gab and Minds and Brighteon. But we also have all the audio-only podcast platforms that we highlight as well, that we post to as well. Again, that's 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. While I'm taking just a quick moment to do that, I should just say a quick hello out to everyone in the live chat. I hope you had a great weekend. I really appreciate you kicking off your week on Monday with me here today. Hi to Tim Martin in Arizona, Haji in Michigan, Mr. Green Bottle, Liberty Revolutionary, good to see you as well. AM in also in Michigan, Kings Farm in Missouri, Cowboy Roy Robert Rogers says nullify. Got the, I mean, if you want the TLDW, too long didn't watch on this one, that's really what it gets down to. Don't comply, nullify. There's Clay Kent, Happy Snowfish, Natural Law in Iowa, Brando, Dixie Strong in Alabama, Joseph said, let's get the usurpers out. King Nobody in Colorado, Alan Hughes, Chakota Carver, and everyone else. I know I'm missing a few people. I'm just trying to scroll through this relatively quickly. If I have a few minutes later in the episode, I will do my best to take a look at some comments and questions. A couple of reasons why I love that you leave your feedback. One, I read through all of it, usually not the same day, but sometime in the next 24, 48 hours after the live stream is done. And I get a ton of ideas for future episodes from your feedback, questions, etc. And then on top of it, the more that you engage with the episode, especially on these live streaming video platforms, the mainstream ones, the more that you engage with it, the more likely they are to show us to more people. It's just all algorithm basic stuff. Anyways, 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty is where you're going to want to check out to get all the source documents. So the first thing that people do is they demand that politicians in office stop doing the stuff that they weren't supposed to do in the first place. The second thing they do is they go for a federal lawsuit in the hopes that the federal judges will limit federal power. But there's some problems with that as well. Here's how James Madison put it in his famous report of 1800, explaining the Virginia resolutions of 1798 against the hated Alien and Sedition Acts from John Adams and company. And here's how Madison put it. Dangerous powers not delegated may not only be usurped and executed. I love that someone, I think it was Joseph, in the live chat said, get rid of the usurpers. And that's usurpation of power. If we talk about the American system is based on power flowing from the people, as George Mason and Mercy Otis Warren and so many others told us. The top of the food chain is supposed to be the people of the several states. And all governments, these are just emanations of a delegation of power from the people. But when government does stuff that it's not authorized to do, it's usurpation is how the founders call it. It's stealing. It's a theft of sovereign power of the people. And it's, well, pretty nasty stuff. So anyways, Madison points out that it's not just the legislative and executive branches that can be dangerous. It's also the judiciary. He said dangerous powers not delegated may not only be usurped and executed by the other departments, but the judicial department also may exercise or sanction. So he's not just saying they will just maybe rubber stamp stuff of the other branches, but they may go beyond their limits. And well, I should do an episode on that at some point. May also exercise or sanction dangerous powers beyond the grant of the Constitution. And I think dangerous powers beyond the grant, it's a little bit redundant. Madison was a little bit more pragmatic about this at that point, but I think you guys get the gist. And we don't need to go far beyond the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. There's so many examples of how the judiciary has sanctioned dangerous powers beyond the grant of the Constitution. One of the primary places is the so-called Interstate Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And the worst of that started, of course, during the FDR, the court packing threat era, with the case of Wickard versus Filburn in 1942. And then that was reaffirmed. Basically, what we've gotten was interstate commerce was supposed to be a power that, you know, only addressed actual commercial activity that went across state lines. And over the years, that has basically been twisted and turned through the court system into basically anything that might conceivably affect interstate commerce. So they started with a major precedent in 1942, and that probably built on a few others before that. But this was reaffirmed by Scalia and company in a case, Gonzalez versus Raich, in 2005, where Clarence Thomas, he was in the opposition on that, was 5-4, I think it was, in 2005. And he said, if they can regulate the growing of plants in someone's backyard that's never crossed state line, they have basically unlimited power. He warned about that. And of course, well, the court went the wrong way on it anyways. And then that was used as a justification in support of the Affordable Care Act in NFIB versus Sebelius in 2012. I'm not just going to get into a bunch of court cases today, but it's important to point out that even if you like some of the things that the court does today, and everybody seems, there's always different groups of people that like what the court does currently, overall, it's generally been a rubber stamp, a sanction of increasing federal power over and over and over. Now, here's how Lysander Spooner put it. In A Defense for Fugitive Slaves, which is one of my favorite papers by him, along with Trial by Jury and a few others, this is from 1850. He said, "There is not a syllable in the Constitution that makes a decision of the judiciary of its own force and without regard to its correctness binding upon anybody." In other words, the judiciary, they have an opinion on the Constitution. It even says opinion of the court. Their view is not law. It's an opinion. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, whether the Supreme Court happens to follow it or not. And Spooner went further. He said, "An unconstitutional judicial decision is no more binding than an unconstitutional legislative enactment." Here's Thomas Jefferson in a letter to William Charles Jarvis in 1820. He warned about looking to the federal courts to protect us, to save us, to make all decisions for us. He said, "You seem to consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions. A very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy." What a surprise. If you look all around us, it's probable that Jefferson was right on that prediction. So that's the second thing that people try to do. First thing is, you know, ask that the people in power stop using the power that they weren't supposed to use. The second thing is to find one branch of the institution in power to stop another branch of the institution in power. And, well, that isn't working too well either. And the third thing is they'll try to vote the bums out in the hopes that we'll just get new bums that aren't really bums. Or once they get in there, they will just look at all that power that's been left for them and say, "Oh, no thanks, all good, we don't need this." As if human nature does not get drawn, it does not draw the worst of the worst of the worst to come and try to utilize and wield that power. It is very, very unique when you find someone who does not. Even if you like the short-term results, the problem really is the power, but that's probably another episode. Anyway, so number three is they try to vote the bums out. And here's how Lysander Spooner puts it. He said, "To say that an unconstitutional law must be obeyed until it is repealed is saying that an unconstitutional law is just as obligatory as a constitutional one." Now, I don't think Spooner's takes on the Constitution were always right or always wrong, but he certainly, if you don't at least think about some of the things he had to say, you're missing some really, really great insight here. But this one, I think, really hammers it home. Because the notion that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, that means it's the supreme law of the land even when the government violates it. And if the government violates it, and the only way to actually respond to it is wait for the government to stop violating it, that means the entire time that you've waited to vote all the bums out or get these lawsuits or do your protests and all that, and people are still complying with it, that means the unconstitutional act, whether it's for 6 months or 1 year or 4 years or 6 years, they have been in force and they have the same legal force as the constitutional ones. And that is absurd on its face. And Spooner was reiterating a long-held view here from the beginning of the revolution. Now, I don't think he actually cited it that way, but this is the same approach that the founders and the old revolutionaries took. And for those of you who listen to me blab on a regular basis, you know that we look at the beginning of the American Revolution not as April of 1775, the battles. The battles were an outgrowth of the revolution, the real American Revolution, as John Adams called it, which was a revolution in thought. And we trace the beginning of that to 1761 and Patrick Henry, 1764, but 1761, James Otis Jr.'s great speech against the writs of assistance, where he was reiterating or affirming this view of sovereignty. If the people hold the final authority and the Constitution is the supreme law, now, of course, he was talking about an unwritten Constitution at that point, but if the Constitution is the supreme law, it doesn't matter what the government happens to say. If they violate the Constitution and they think they didn't, that's too bad, so sad. So Spooner was really, really reiterating this. Soon as they do that act beyond the Constitution, to say that it has to be obeyed means that that unconstitutional act is in full legal force until the government who gave it to you decides that the government shouldn't have done it in the first place. James Otis Jr. put it like this, a little bit shorter. An act against the Constitution is void. A void act doesn't need to be obeyed until it's repealed. It's void the moment they try to do anything, soon as they actually suggest it, it's void. Here's how Thomas Jefferson put it. Whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. So Jefferson has the same view as Spooner some decades later. Here's Jefferson in 1798. An unconstitutional law is no law at all. It is unauthoritative, void, and no force. Now, again, what does the free people do about it? Again, this is these three approaches. Demanding that government stop doing stuff that the government's not supposed to do in the first place. That's what really all of them get down to. They're basically saying, wait till you can convince the federal government to stop doing the stuff the federal government never should have been doing, in the hopes that the federal government will decide that the federal government was wrong and that the federal government is going to love the Constitution and liberty. Now, that doesn't mean you ignore all these approaches, the vote, the bums out, the protests, the phone calls, the lawsuits, all that stuff. That doesn't mean just don't do them, because it's part of the whole structure. But most people make that their primary or their only approach, and none of them are supposed to be the only or primary approach. Thomas Jefferson, as an example, here he is back again in 1798 against the Alien and Sedition Acts in his Kentucky Resolutions, his first draft here. He said, he tells us when the vote the bums out strategy is supposed to be used if you're talking about a free people defending their own constitution and their own liberty. He said, in cases of an abuse of the delegated powers, the members of the general government being chosen by the people, a change by the people would be the constitutional remedy. That's, well, when they are within the bounds of the Constitution, an abuse of the delegated powers. You don't like how they've used the powers that have been delegated to them in the Constitution, but they are still within the bounds of the Constitution. Then you change them out. That's what Thomas Jefferson had to say. But he continued, soon as they go beyond that limit. And he wrote on this in 1791 as well, his opinion on the constitutionality of a national bank. He said to take a single step beyond the boundaries thus drawn around Congress is to take a boundless field of power. He recognized, like so many others from the founding generation, from the old revolutionaries, he recognized that as soon as you set a precedent for government to do something that they weren't authorized to do, other people will be drawn to the power that's in the office or in the government, and they'll say, well, if they could do it, then I could go a little further and a little further and a little further. And John Dickinson gave a really great warning about that in his Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania. As I mentioned before, I will link to this all in the show notes so you can read it, so I don't have to cover every single word here myself. I always try to do my best, but you'll find that over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/path to liberty. So a single step beyond the limits of the Constitution, not only big things, a single step is, if you allow it to take place and you allow it to establish the detestable precedent, which I'll get to in a moment, then they will build upon that, because no one looks at the power that of the people who were in office before them as the ceiling, the limit of what they can do. They look at it as the floor, the base, and they want to build upon it. And that's where Jefferson put it this way. He said, first he's saying when they're within the bounds of the Constitution, but you don't like how they're using that power or they're abusing it, then you change the people out. But where powers are assumed which have not been delegated, a nullification of the act is the rightful remedy. Not a good idea to try later, not something to think about, not something to wait until you've done all the other stuff. It is the rightful remedy for every act beyond the limitations of the Constitution, to Thomas Jefferson. He said that every state, and in this situation, Jefferson and both Madison, they use the term state in many ways. Madison himself, in that report of 1800, I think it was five, if not six ways, and he talks about the different ways we use the term state. Sometimes it's the state governments, sometimes it's the people of the states, but in this situation, we're really talking about the people of the several states. And he said that every state has a natural right, in cases not within the compact, to nullify of their own authority all assumption of power by others within their limits. So to take action to stop the implementation or effectuation of those acts that are not delegated, that are not authorized by the Constitution, and they don't have to wait for approval from anyone else. And he specifically answers that question. They nullify of their own authority. He said, without this right, they would be under the dominion, absolute and unlimited, of whosoever might exercise this right of judgment for them. So leaving that decision up to the judges, as he wrote some years later, puts you under the despotism of an oligarchy, because you can't make that decision for yourself. You have to wait for the people who are offending your liberty, who are attacking your Constitution. You have to wait for part of that instrumentality to actually tell you that, oh, sorry, too bad, we did the wrong thing. We're never going to get in trouble for it either. We'll just have to, you'll just have to be grateful that we decided to stop doing it. And that really is a population on its knees begging for permission. And that really is this original question I'm talking about. What does a free people do? We're not talking about what we do today, because in today's climate, no one should say that we live in a land of the free, because this is the free people don't do any of the things that they're supposed to be doing. Well, small amounts, but on a large scale, absolutely not. And John Dickinson asked that same question in 1788. He pointed out that a good constitution can't guarantee that you're going to have a good administration. The best it can do is promote it. But he said, you know, we've got this thing that I'm supporting, and Dickinson was one of the primary authors, if not the primary author, of the Articles of Confederation. He decided to support the Constitution in 1788, and he was writing in support in his Fabius letters. Here in his number 4, he said, look, it doesn't matter how good of a constitution we have, eventually you might have a bad administration. And the question has to be asked, what must be done? What must be done when you have a bad administration? And we have that constantly, obviously. He said, it must be granted that a bad administration may take place. What is then to be done? The answer is instantly found before the supreme sovereignty of the people. The answer is found in the hands of the people themselves. And he said, it is their duty to watch and their right to take care that the Constitution be preserved, or in the Roman phrase, on perilous occasions, that the Republic receive no damage. Period. So it's up to the people. And even Alexander Hamilton, and I've been citing him a little bit more and more lately. If you follow me on Twitter, which you should, it's at Michael Bolden, all spelled out. You'll notice in my profile, or my whatever they call it on Twitter, it lists that I'm a Hamilton hater, because people don't like it that I rail on him sometimes. But on the other hand, when he gets things right, or when he points out things that I think are very interesting, I think it has a lot more impact, because this is a guy that gave us a lot of the foundation for the monster state of today, especially with his push for the National Bank in 1791, where he did one of the greatest flip-flop, one of the worst flip-flops in American history, where before ratification, he talked about things, the federal government only having those powers expressly delegated to it. He said there was not going to be any implied powers. And then suddenly when he wanted his national bank, then all of a sudden there's implied powers everywhere. And the word, for example, necessary no longer meant necessarily, it meant merely convenient. And then years later, John Marshall took Alexander Hamilton's approach on necessary and proper, and in some places copied Alexander Hamilton word for word. And that there in and of itself is really the basis for what we have today. They use that in conjunction with general welfare, commerce, etc., to give us power over almost everything all the time. And it's not giving to us. They're taking it from us. But Hamilton actually made a really good point in Federalist number 33. And maybe he was just doing this to try to sell people on ratification, but it's absolutely correct. He said, and he was talking about the Supremacy Clause in Federalist 33, and he's just describing how it works. You know, in this situation, you know, the larger society gets delegated certain stuff, and they can only do things that are pursuant to the Constitution. But he asked then, or he's answering the question, well, what happens
when they go beyond that. He said, it will not follow from this doctrine that acts of the large society, which are not pursuant to its constitutional powers, which are invasions of the residuary authorities of the smaller societies, will become the supreme law of the land. It's not supreme law if they go beyond the limits of the Constitution, if they do stuff that are not pursuant to the delegated powers of the Constitution. It's the same view as Jefferson, but then the layers for Hamilton really is, well, all these words that mean certain things now mean whatever the government wants them to. But the underlying principle here is, soon as they go beyond the limits of the Constitution, it is not supreme. It's not the supreme law of the land. He said these will be merely acts of usurpation and will deserve to be treated as such. And that's the really important point there. Soon as they go beyond the limits of the Constitution, the acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. They're acts of usurpation to Hamilton. An act against the Constitution is void. We can take Spooner and Dickinson and all these people. It's the same view. And then you add Hamilton's, and they deserve to be treated as such. Because if they're void, do you treat a void contract as binding and enforceable? If you make a deal with someone in business and it's been voided out and everyone agrees that it's void, do you still continue paying the dude for his services? Now, that's stupid, right? No one would do that in their right mind. But yet we have that all the time today, because if you're supposed to treat a void act, unauthoritative, void, and of no force as exactly that, and then you continue following all that stuff, you're not doing the job right. And mind you, all of us do this. I do this constantly. There's so many laws and regulations on the books, it's impossible to resist all of them. But we have to actually start thinking along these lines, because James Iredell, as many others told us, this is how you keep the government in check. He said the people will resist if the government usurp powers not delegated to it. He was saying, look, same thing that Dickinson was saying. This was in the North Carolina Ratifying Convention, also in 1788. He's saying, look, you're going to come up with situations where government doesn't do the right thing, but that shouldn't stop us from trying to move forward and do the right thing. In response to them doing the wrong thing, this is how you keep them in check. That was James Iredell, who went on to be one of the first associate justices on the Supreme Court. Roger Sherman, same thing. Here he is in December of 1787, said all acts of the Congress not warranted by the Constitution would be void. Same message from James Otis Jr. in 1761 through Roger Sherman in 1787 to Alexander Hamilton, probably the following year, early 1788. All acts of Congress outside of the Constitution, that's all acts of government outside of the Constitution, are void. Nor, Roger Sherman said, could they be enforced contrary to assent to the sense of a majority of the states. And I think there is a very important point that is made here. It's implied here. It's not said expressly, but first of all, there's the legal foundation or the moral constitutional foundation that soon as they go beyond the limits of the Constitution, those acts are void. But then they deserve to be treated as such, because Sherman understood that when government went beyond its limits, just because you waved a paper at it or you said these are void, that doesn't stop the government from doing the wrong thing in the first place. He recognized, just like Iredell and so many others, that there would be a response. Now, of course, that response really relies upon a people who not only understand the Constitution, but want it enforced, who love liberty and want to see it advanced, instead of those who love government. We're literally surrounded by the latter, unfortunately, today. And some people maybe not as bad as others in their own personal community, but the vast majority of people on one issue or another love government power. But Sherman is pointing out that lack of enforcement, if you can't enforce, if the government can't enforce, the other important point here is that people aren't complying. Because if everyone complies, there's nothing for government to enforce. So there's no conflict about the federal government having to try to enforce it over the sense of a majority of the states. It means the implication is people would have to resist, James, just like James Iredell was saying, or hear what James Madison said a few weeks after Sherman in Federalist 46. He advised that we utilize a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. And Madison said, if a single state did this,
a single state, a large state, did it, it would make it very difficult for the feds to deal with it. And if a bunch of adjoining states or a number of states took the same approach, it would create an environment the federal government would hardly be willing to encounter. That's James Madison's words, father of the Constitution. You know, that dude, he basically said if a bunch of states refused to comply at a time when the government was going to be completely tiny in comparison to what we have today, not even relying on the states to implement all their stuff like they do today. At that point, Madison considered this the effective way to keep the government in check. And you can read Federalist 46. I will link to it in the show notes. And even Hamilton again. Now, in Federalist 16, he was recognizing this refusal to comply on the state and local level, the individual level, was incredibly effective. But the context was he was complaining about that. He didn't like that in Federalist 16. He said, if the interposition of the state legislatures be necessary to give effect to a measure of the union, they have only not to act or to act evasively, and the measure is defeated. So if the federal government does stuff that relies on states to help them enforce it, and then the states say, nah, we don't want to do it, Hamilton understood the same thing that we understand today. All the states have to do is do hands off, don't act, don't do anything to help the feds, or act evasively, and the measure is defeated. Now, for Hamilton, he was talking about states, state legislatures, for individuals, when individuals resisted. Hamilton was not on our side whatsoever, and I don't think he was on our side on this either, but he believed in crushing noncompliance, using military might to crush noncompliance, as can be seen by the stuff that he really pushed for over the whiskey tax a few years later. But he recognized the effectiveness of this, and he wanted the federal government to act directly on the people so it didn't have to rely on the state governments. And that's much of what they set up. But today, the government is so big that it relies on the states to implement most federal programs. Now, so for many others outside of Hamilton, of course, opposition, resistance, disobedience, refusing to comply was a moral imperative. There was a moral foundation to this, to the founders, to the old revolutionaries. There was a duty to refuse. It is their duty to watch, is how John Dickinson put it, and their right to take care that the Constitution be preserved. It's up to the people to protect and preserve their own Constitution and their own liberty. Here's how Patrick Henry put it in response to the Stamp Act of 1765. When they go beyond the limits and they do these taxes that are only supposed to be done if we decide here locally, if we decide, it's up to us. If they try to do it, the far-off government, then you are not bound to yield obedience. So this is a moral approach from Patrick Henry. John Dickinson took a very similar one, but he said, and again, this is in response to the Stamp Act, this is talking about establishing a precedent. If you comply with the act by using the stamped papers, he said, you rivet perpetual chains upon your unhappy country because compliance establishes, he wrote, the detestable precedent. The detestable precedent for those who want to expand that power, the ones who want to put those chains around you. And so he called the Stamp Act a test of your disposition. So any act that goes beyond the limits of government's delegated powers, of its rightful authority, I guess we could call it at least at that point, is a test of the disposition of the people. Why? Because he said, if you quietly bend your necks to that yoke, you prove yourselves ready to receive any bondage to which your lords and masters shall please to subject you. And if you're looking at the image up on the screen, there is some bold and highlight on there on lords and masters. And he used that in the original broadside against the Stamp Act as well, which will, I think I have a link to that one handy for the show notes. I know I've had posted it before, but I'm not sure if I have it in my notes today, but I'll see if I can get that over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. And then here's Thomas Jefferson. Of course, a free people claim their rights. So if we're asking, what does a free people do? Now, some people ask the government to stop doing things, and sometimes the government will stop doing those things in response to that ask. I mean, not very often, because if it was the case, we wouldn't live under the largest government in history that keeps growing and growing and growing, no matter which team is in charge.
That's a fact. It constantly happens. It keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So asking government to stop doing stuff is clearly a totally failed strategy. And if you want to ask, go for it. But there has to be something more that's the primary focus. And Jefferson said, a free people claim their rights as derived from the laws of nature and not as the gift of their chief magistrate. Samuel Adams summed it up like this. And ultimately, again, it takes a people who loves liberty, who understands the value of it, is willing to defend it, has the backbone to do that. He said, the truth is, all might be free if they valued freedom and defended it as they ought. If they valued freedom and defended it as they ought. Ultimately, it's up to we, the people, to learn how to protect and defend our own Constitution and our own liberty, whether the government happens to like it or not. There is absolutely nothing that helps us get this kind of information out to more and more people every single day, more than the financial faith and support of our members. If you've got a couple of bucks of that quickly devaluing government fiat that you've got laying around, I know things are very tight for a lot of people today, but any consideration you can give to joining us today, our memberships start out at just $2 a month. We also have annual 5-year and lifetime options over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/members. Again, 10thamendmentcenter.com/members. I'll probably look over in the chat a little bit later today. I see a lot of comments back and forth from Haji and Natural Law, Joseph, and a few others. There's Sharon Patriot, Douglas Fox, Kings, and others. Lots of interesting stuff. I'll probably have to take a little bit more time to read it later, but I appreciate your feedback. Continue leaving comments, reviews on Apple Podcasts, smashing the like button, comments in the archive, sharing. All that stuff will help us reach and teach more people. So whether you're able to help join us as a member today or you're able to help share the links and reviews and feedback, all that stuff helps out a great deal. I'm very grateful for your support. I'm grateful that you decided to spend a little time with me today. I hope you enjoyed this information as much as I enjoyed sharing it with you. And I will see you next time here on the Path to Liberty.